I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. Today, a conversation with the outgoing chair of the Johns Hopkins Sociology Department, Carl Alexander. He recently completed a 25-year-long study, his life's work, examining the lives of nearly 800 Baltimoreans from the time they entered first grade up until they were nearing the age of 30. He and his team of researchers examined the role that family and economic status play in determining failure or success in life. While many Americans believe that anyone can overcome poverty, Carl Alexander's research found just the opposite in Baltimore, that if you were born here in the late 1970s, you probably stayed that way. We'll hear about his quarter-century-long study on Midday after the news. And good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday Friday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. Americans like to believe that if you work hard and persevere, you can rise out of poverty and even into the upper echelons of our society and achieve the American dream. As a nation, we idealize the stories of people pulling themselves up by their bootstraps, keeping their nose to the grindstone, using a little elbow grease and insert other platitude here, escape hardship and find success. My guest this hour, sociologist Carl Alexander, spent the majority of his career at Johns Hopkins examining the belief in Baltimore, this belief that I describe, and found it to be largely false for a certain class of people. He and his team devoted 25 years collecting and comparing data from the lives of nearly 800 school students in Baltimore from a sampling of 20 public schools to see how much a child's origins affected his life trajectory. The researchers began observing the lives of these children as they entered first grade at age 6 back in the early 1980s and continued to follow them until the subjects were in their late 20s. They compared the life's course of low-income African Americans and low-income whites to the lives of those born in more affluent families. Their findings are now published in a book entitled The Long Shadow: Family Background, Disadvantaged Youth, and the Transition into Adulthood. The book takes a look not only at the subjects' families and their socioeconomic status, but the status of their neighborhoods of origin and the schools they attended. Carl Alexander, we welcome you to Midday. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me on. I'm looking forward to it.
Carl is the outgoing chairman of the sociology department at Johns Hopkins. You're actually retiring later this summer.
Yeah, I am indeed on my way out. I started at Hopkins in 1972.
Wow.
Right out of graduate school, and it's been a good run, I've had many happy years at Hopkins, but 40 years is plenty, and I'm ready to move on and relax a little.
About 10 years into your career in Hopkins, you started this project. So I wanted to spend a little time here at the beginning talking about what brought you to the project, what was the purpose, what did you aim to do at the beginning there?
Sure. We could spend a couple of weeks discussing, just talking about the background of the project. But the short version of it is that my collaborator, my long-term collaborator and dear friend Doris Entwistle and I were both on the faculty in the sociology department at the time. Doris is my senior colleague and my professional mentor. And we were both interested in trying to understand how children get along in life, and in particular where the experience of schooling fits into the picture. And we were particularly interested in understanding why it is that some children get off to a more successful start in their educational careers and other children have a bumpy road. And so in order to explore that issue, we decided we would try to look on carefully as a group of Baltimore City Public School children kind of began their schooling. We call the project the Beginning School Study because we focused on the first grade experience. And as you mentioned, we have a reasonably large sample that we picked up, 800.
It's impressive. 800, did you start with 800 at the outset?
Yeah, we did. Actually, to be more precise, it's 790, but 800 is a good round number.
Close to 800, yeah.
And the original intent was to look on carefully at how these children did in first grade and talk to the parents, talk to their teachers, get information about the schools they attended. And then into second grade, we would look to see what the repercussions were. You know, what the children who had a more successful launch, were they continuing to be more successful than the children who struggled? What happened to them in second grade? And we, in fact, did that. But the original idea for the project was that that would be the end of it. We'd
just put in a couple of years of
a couple of years of observations and
so
talking
with
the kids.
So what made you decide to go further with it and ended up being 25 years?
Yeah, well, two grew into 25. we didn't have an end point in sight, but once we were well into the project in the first grade, we realized that we had effectively done all the heavy lifting to get the infrastructure of the project in place. At the time, we had terrific support from the superintendent's office. We started out in 20 schools, and they were scattered throughout the city. We had permission from all the principals to come into their schools and from all the first grade teachers to work with their children.
How did you pick the schools, those 20 schools? So you wanted to have a sample here that showed you different, ethnic background, racial background, socioeconomic status, right?
Yeah, we wanted the sample of schools and of children to be as broadly diverse as was possible in the Baltimore City public school system at the time, which, as you know, was substantially low income and minority in its enrollments.
Mm-hmm.
And so to be sure that we could make the kinds of comparisons across social lines that you just alluded to, comparing the experiences of black children with white children, and more middle-class children with working-class children. We selected schools in the first stage of it strategically. So we organized schools based on their racial makeup, racial composition, schools that had predominantly white enrollments, predominantly African-American, and then were racially integrated or mixed enrollments. So we had three categories of racial makeup. And then we also classified schools in terms of whether they were in working class or lower income communities and middle class communities. And then within that set of classification, then we selected schools at random. It was like there were six cells, and we effectively pulled the names of schools out of a hat.
Hmm.
And then we went and talked to the principals about what we were about and managed to obtain permission to work in those schools. And then in selecting children, we went through a similar process. I mean, once we had the sample of schools, we didn't have to go through that exercise of classifying. But we wanted a representative random sample of children. And so we worked from kindergarten rosters from the previous year, which would allow us to be ready to hit the ground running in the fall of first grade. So from kindergarten rosters, we randomly sampled children in every one of the that would be in every one of the first grade classes. And then in the early fall, we did some supplemental sampling to make sure we picked up children who might have done kindergarten someplace else or not done kindergarten at all, which was possible at that time.
What did you get to know about the children? You get to know their family background, their family's income, the household income, that kind of information?
Well, we didn't ask questions about income. That was one of the few areas that we didn't touch upon. But from school records, we knew whether they qualified for reduced price meals at school, which classifies families as being low income or not. So
mm-hmm. And there's a difference when we use the terminology low income versus poverty.
Yeah.
There's actually a distinction there.
Oh, there is. It often gets sloughed over.
Poverty is that we go by the federal guideline for poverty, right? But low income is twice poverty level, am I right?
Yeah, well, in terms of the federal guidelines, it's a little bit more complicated than that, but not much more complicated. So children qualify for reduced price meals if their family income is 1.3 times the federal poverty line.
Okay.
And they qualify for free meals if they're 1.8 times the federal poverty line. So it really is low income, not poverty, but it's easy to conflate the two, and people often make that mistake.
Carl Alexander, let's talk about the Baltimore these children were born into. These children were born in the late 70s because you picked them up in first grade in
1982.
Okay,
yeah.
So they're born in Baltimore in the late 70s. A little bit of background here on the city at that time. William Donald Schaefer is mayor in the 70s. The city is already has been losing population for a while. There's some serious things going on in terms of jobs and the economy in Baltimore.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It was not a pretty picture during the time when the project launched, and it got less pretty, even more so, less pretty over the time that our children were going through the elementary grades into middle school and then high school. So it's the deindustrialization script, and it wasn't peculiar to Baltimore, but Baltimore was hit particularly hard by deindustrialization because our economy was so dependent during the World War II and post-World War II era on heavy industry, You know, Betts Steel at the height of the war was the largest steel mill in the world with 35,000 workers. Now, as you well know, it's being sold off for scrap. I mean, Betts Steel is no more. So we had reason to think that these children, many of them, were going to face a difficult future, you know, with what was happening in the kind of broader, you know, Baltimore context. And indeed, many of them did. But others managed to kind of rise above the difficult circumstances and do quite well. And that was one of the things we were interested in trying to understand. When we came to the idea of extending the study over more than 2 years, and we didn't know it was going to go for 25, but we had an idea that we were committed to doing it for a while longer. But being able to stick with it through 25 years meant that we were able to get a sense of where these young people were in their lives as young adults.
How frequently did you get updates on their lives? After first grade, you and Doris Entwistle would go back and track them in fourth grade, fifth grade?
To see goodness. Well,
how would you do that?
This was done in an unusual exercise because it was basically a mom-and-pop survey operation. We didn't outsource anything. We did it all ourselves with the help of lots of other folks. So my co-authors on the book are Doris Entwistle, but also Linda Olson, who was a research associate with us for many years. And we would expand our staffing when we were ready to go out into the field and process data and then contract in between years. But it was very labor-intensive. So for the children, we interviewed them individually starting in first grade twice annually through the end of elementary school and into middle school. And then after the middle grades, we went to a spring-only interview schedule. The idea there was that we would carry them through high school, but for the youngsters who were still in school after 13 years, we did a 13-year survey. A good many of our study youngsters had to repeat a grade along the way, and so their schooling was extended by a year. And some who had dropped out came back, and so it took them a bit longer to finish up as well.
How many dropped out of that 800? Do you remember how many just dropped out and didn't finish high school?
Well, there's a difference between dropping out and not finishing high school. And so one of the things about being able to, you know, track the same group over time is that you can see all the details and nuance. So the dropout rate throughout the panel, the sample, was 40% overall. And it was higher among those we classify as having grown up in low-income or disadvantaged families. It was 48%, as I recall. But many of those youngsters went on to do the GED, which by federal government accounting is high school completion.
Right. And you tracked them until they were 28 years old,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So that many of them probably got a GED
along the way. Yeah, many did. And 10% of the dropouts returned to high school and completed with regular high school degrees. So leaving school is not necessarily the end of the story. At age 28, those we refer to as permanent dropouts, so still without any kind of high school certification, was 25% of the panel. So down from 40% to 25%. It's a very meaningful, very significant difference. And so many of these young people growing up realize that they've made a bad decision along the way by not being more focused on school and whatnot, and they try to do something about it. In fact, it's quite extraordinary. When we talk to them at age 28, 85% of those who did not have high school certification at that point said they intended to get additional schooling. This idea that doing well in school and staying the course is the way to be successful in life, that's the American ethos, and it really does filter through. These young people, many of them from low-income, disadvantaged family circumstances, they believe that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is not exclusive to the middle class and children of more privileged background.
There's one thing before we go on. We're going to take our first break here, Carl, and we're going to come back and talk some more. In the late 70s, early 80s, the term permanent underclass came into usage. It might have been older than that. I remember it being used quite a bit in the press, in the media anyway, in the 70s and 80s. People would refer to a class of very poor, urban poor, mostly black in New York City, black, Hispanic, who were stuck in poverty, and there was no plan, no hope for them getting out of that because they were in low-performing schools, high unemployment areas. As you said, the loss of manufacturing, it would not be easy for them to find even good blue-collar jobs that would get them out of poverty, at least a step up into the middle class. So can I ask, is that something you were looking at here, whether the permanent underclass indeed exists, whether that's a truism?
Well, we were looking at the issue, but we weren't looking at the permanent underclass. We have a discussion in the book about what the underclass is thought to mean, mm-hmm. in both the professional literature and in kind of common parlance, and it carries with it some pejorative connotations about being prone to delinquent behavior and welfare dependence and all those
mm-hmm. substance abuse.
So you know, values and behaviors that just aren't polite in terms of middle class society, and so we prefer thinking about the urban disadvantage as disadvantaged in terms of their, and so our focus is on the circumstances of family life when they're growing up in terms of their the urban disadvantage. It's about half of our group. Their parents didn't finish high school. Almost all of them were low income, and their parents, when they were working, from year to year, when we ask these questions of the parents directly, not just the children. The unemployment rate among their parents, fathers, was about 25%, which is very high. And amongst the mothers, it was higher still. So we classify families in terms of their material conditions, you know, economic well-being and so forth. And then we look to see how these children do over time. We were very explicit in the book about not wanting to overlay that with the pejorative connotations or implications of the underclass label.
Mm-hmm, right.
So our agenda is to look at these kids intensively and to try to understand their family conditions, neighborhood conditions, their experiences at schooling, and then to play it forward and see what follows from all that.
The purpose of this study, of this book, I'm reading here from the preface of your book, The Long Shadow, is to improve our understanding of how social contexts, especially those of family, neighborhood, and school, bear on the long-term well-being of disadvantaged urban youth. Well-being is captured not only in objective measures such as educational level, occupation, earnings, family formation, and avoidance of problem behaviors such as drug abuse, but also in this, self-perceptions of well-being and life satisfaction. I'm reading there from the book by our guest in this hour of midday, Carl Alexander of the Sociology Department at Johns Hopkins University, along with Doris Entwistle and Linda Olson, the authors of this report, now published as a book by Russell Sage Foundation. This is Midday. We're going to take our first break here. We'll come back and talk some more with Carl Alexander about his long study, nearly a quarter century long, nearly 800 Baltimoreans who he first met as first graders and followed them along until their late 20s. You can join our conversation if you have a question for Carl, 410-662-8780, the Midday email address, midday@wypr.org. Dan Rodericks here, back with Carl Alexander of the Sociology Department at Johns Hopkins University, co-author of The Long Shadow, Family Background, Disadvantaged Youth, and the Transition to Adulthood. This book is a culmination of 25 years of research conducted by Carl Alexander and his colleagues, Doris Entwistle and Linda Olson. I should say the late Doris Entwistle.
Yeah.
She was with you throughout this project and died last year.
She died 4 months before the book was sent in for the final revisions of it. So she knew it was finished. She was very pleased to be able to be part of that, but she's no longer with us, one of cancer's many victims.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about the title. And did Doris know the title was going to be The Long Shadow?
Oh, indeed, yeah. Yes,
so
indeed.
That refers to family, right? Yeah. Your family circumstances?
That's right. Yeah, so the imagery is that the conditions of experienced early in life through family, neighborhood, and school cast a long shadow in the sense that they have implications for children's well-being and academic and personal development all along the way. And in the information we've been able to compile and put together, you certainly see that. It comes across vividly. There's nothing set in stone. Mm-hmm. It's easy to overstate the case that you know, the hope is never lost. And some of our youngsters who grew up in very difficult circumstances went on to be very successful and have comfortable lives.
Some did.
But the patterns are very real. We're sociologists. We look at trends. We look at patterns. And for every rule, there are exceptions. But the rules are quite real. And what we find is that those who are born into more advantaged households as young adults themselves wind up in more advantaged social positions. They're much more likely to continue on into college and to complete college, and then to get high-paying professional and middle-class positions. The differences in college completion are really quite striking. There's a tenfold difference across social lines. At age 28, 45% of those that we classify as having been from better-off family circumstances in first grade, as first graders, 45% of those have a baccalaureate degree or above. Some have master's degrees and some have PhDs. That's against 4% of children who are born into disadvantaged family circumstances. And it's not for want of interest, and it's not for want of trying. These youngsters have a very tough road to haul. And we see evidence of those difficulties all the way back to first grade. That's the whole purpose of having this long-term perspective, to see how it all unfolds over time.
Well, as I said at the beginning of the show, there is this idea in America, it's probably an idea in other countries too, that you can rise above these circumstances, even in one generation. And people will point anecdotally to other families where that has happened. You didn't see it here.
Well, it is an idea, and it's one that's precious to all of us. And as you mentioned, there are these rags to riches, Horatio Alger stories, and we take great delight in them. Before we as a nation fall far short on delivering on that promise, that there's a literature now that looks at the issue internationally, and it finds that the children in the United States, or their prospects for doing well later in life, are more dependent on their family's conditions, the family income, parents' education level, than in most other industrialized countries throughout the world. So we lag behind. And to try to achieve a deeper understanding of why that is, and what some of the mechanisms and dynamics are to drive it, is in large measure what motivated this project.
Carl Alexander, in terms of some of the measures of success, let's take one, for instance, college education, the baccalaureate that you mentioned.
Yeah.
How did that break down racially in your this large cohort that you studied, nearly 800 kids?
Well, there are racial differences won't surprise. But in point of fact, the larger differences, and they're vastly larger, are differences having to do with family economic circumstances. So I mentioned just a couple minutes ago the 45% to 4% differential in BA degree completion, comparing the higher standing families with the lower. That's a tenfold difference. The difference on average comparing African Americans and whites is on the order of 12 or 13% in terms of college completion. Now, that's not trivial. It makes a very real difference in the long-term prospects of these young people. But at least insofar as the experiences of schooling, and this is all the way through from first grade forward onto through the college years, the larger differences in terms of doing well and struggling revolve around family economic conditions and not race per se, and not gender either. I mean, we look at the most successful young people in our group are white women of higher SES background. They have the highest percentage of college completion.
You would say that was the most successful group?
In terms of college completion.
Were females... In terms of college completion, females from the higher echelon, female whites.
That's exactly right. And you see much the same nationally. It plays out here locally, but it's a general trend. They're not necessarily the most successful in terms of their employment experience. It's interesting. Most of the book focuses on the lower income segment of the panel, about half of the group. But it's quite advantageous to us to have children who grew up in more favorable circumstances as a basic comparison. So a fourth of our panel we classify as higher SES. Now, these are not high by the standards of the wider world.
Just for our listeners, when you refer to SES,
socioeconomic status is a group, as a classification that we put together. It's based on parents' educational level, parents' incomes, and job level.
You can continue to use it. I just want to make sure everyone knew what you meant when you say SES.
That's in my DNA.
I know.
As a sociologist.
I know, Professor.
Anyway, what we find is if you look at those who grew up in more favorable circumstances when they were younger, they're much more likely to complete college, the men and the women, but the women more so than the men. But in terms of their employment, the men are much more likely at age 28 to be in executive and managerial positions. The women are more likely to be in professional positions, nursing, teaching, social worker, and the like. And the average earnings of the men is substantially greater than the average earnings of the women. So the women do better at school. The men do better in the world of work. And there's an interesting story behind that if we want to pursue it.
But, go ahead. A little bit from that. Yeah. I'm curious.
Well, what we find when we look across the spectrum of the children's family background, we see that women are substantially still... Here we're talking again Baltimore, children who grew up in Baltimore and went through the public school system. Even in today's world, there's very vivid sex segregation in their occupational positioning. So the women are much more concentrated in the service sector, clerical sector, and to some extent sales. Men are much more likely to have penetrated into the professional managerial ranks. And in terms of blue-collar employment, there are large differences by both gender and also race. So the beginning school study story is substantially a story of African Americans and whites. Back in the day in the 80s, there were very few Latino and Asian students and in the public schools, and that's still substantially the case today. So the African American white comparisons are really quite revealing when you look at the group that did not go to college and where they find themselves as young adults in the world of work. 45% of the white men from working class background were employed in the industrial and construction trades. So working on construction sites, electricians, welders, plumbers. 15% of African American men were working in that sector of the economy, but the whites' earnings were twice the African American earnings. So white men of modest background who don't go to college have much greater access to the high-paying, high-skill, blue-collar work than do African-American men of white background.
What does that tell you? That suggests some discrimination, or it suggests it's access, or it's, what, access to union jobs, what remains of union jobs in those trades?
We don't invoke discrimination because we can't see it, although I don't doubt that there's some of that in play. But what seems to come across more clearly in the information we do have is a pattern of family privilege. And for those of working class background, it's white privilege in terms of accessing jobs in the old, in the remnants of Baltimore's old industrial economy. In terms of being successful at school, it's middle class family privilege. Parents who are able to help their kids get ready for school and to do well at school and to, you know, follow them all along the way and make sure that they
stay the
course.
Help them with their homework.
Yeah, help them with their homework and provide all the resources and enrichment experiences. So when I say family privilege, I don't mean that that's not a pejorative label. It's a descriptive label. And what seems to be happening here, so if you grew up in a family where your dad was a plumber, your uncle was an electrician, across the street your neighbor was working on the docks, that's your life experience. That's what you grew up with, and that's where your parents are. And so working class parents can help open doors for their children through these networks, social networks. So it's in the sociological literature, this concept of social capital. But what it comes down to is parents being able to help their kids. And middle-class parents can help their kids do well in school. White working-class parents can help their kids get good-paying jobs in the high-skill sectors of the blue-collar, non-college labor force. African-American parents don't have those advantages, and neither do their children.
They don't have the connections.
They don't have the networks. And it's interesting. There's a book called Lone Pursuit. It was written by a sociologist at Berkeley. And what she did was look at the low-income African-American and white workers in the blue-collar labor force. And what she found was that African-Americans were much less likely to make referrals of a friend or a relative to an employer than were whites. And her conclusion is that they were reluctant because they were fearful of their own, the consequences for them if the recommendation went bad. You know, if the guy that they had referred didn't show up for work or got in trouble or was stealing.
It's a reflection on them.
It would be a reflection on them. And they didn't have they weren't sturdy enough and they weren't secure enough to run that risk.
What whites wouldn't have that concern?
Not to the same extent.
Yeah.
No, that was her research study. What we find is that we don't have those kinds of data to turn to. But when we asked at age 22 where these young people found their jobs. Many more of the white working class, non-college, said that they were helped by family and friends. And many more of the African Americans said that they found their job on their own.
Yeah.
So these social networks are very, you know, very important. Also, what we find is that the stain of a criminal justice record, having been arrested or incarcerated, is much more of a barrier for young African-American men in finding employment than they are for white men. So if we look, for example, at the white high school dropouts at age 22, 80% of them are working. African-American high school dropouts at age 22, only 40% of them are working. And there
and
is...
some of them, white or black, might have had brushes with the law during that time.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? Yeah.
Actually, I should have said yeah, that these are with a history of,
right.
of with a criminal record, of
yeah.
an arrest record. So, and there is a larger literature beyond our study that points in the same direction, that young African American guys with a criminal record, that's a much greater impediment to finding work than it is for whites of the similar background.
I had another question, something that struck me from your report along the racial lines on when we get to brushes with the law, or even before that, substance abuse.
Yeah. Yeah.
This kind of surprised me and will probably surprise some of our listeners as well. What did you find?
Yeah, I suspect it will. It surprised us, to be honest with you. So at age 28 in our last, this was a decade after high school graduation, for those who graduated on time, we re-interviewed 80% of the original group. Which we felt was quite an accomplishment after 25 years. And among the various things that we discussed with them, we asked about drug use, alcohol use, whether they were regular smokers and the like. And the differences were quite striking and actually quite large, but also somewhat surprising. So the white men from better off family circumstances had the highest self-reported rates of binge drinking, of substance use, that is use of drugs, of what we call heavy substance use, that's something other, a drug other than marijuana, and they were had a much higher rate of being regular smokers. That's white guys from higher SES family background. Reporting this to us. But
okay.
We have reason to think, we've been in their lives a long time.
Reasonably candid
with us.
They know you guys.
They know us.
Yeah.
The next highest levels of all of those things were reported by white men of working class background. So African American men of higher SES, better off family background, I'm sorry, it just
it's
comes
okay.
out. And from working class family background, uh-huh. They had high rates by your standards and my standards of doing all these things, but they lagged far behind the self-reported substance use of whites. And
it is surprising, and I wonder what we draw from it.
Well, one of the things we know, regardless of what we draw from it, is that for those who are better off family circumstances, a lot of what they're doing is in the college environment, where they just don't get as much trouble
right.
for doing these things.
Right.
Now, for working class kids, they're not doing this on college campuses, but it's our sense that their families are better able to buffer adverse repercussions, the white families, than the African Americans, because of these social network ties and the like. What we do know is that an arrest record and having an experience of substance use, I don't want to say abuse, but that's a far less serious impediment to finding employment for the whites of working class background than it is for blacks. So blacks seem to have to pay a bigger, larger penalty for doing these sorts of things.
When they were 28, according from your book here, we interviewed 14 of the 17 white men originally sampled as first graders. At the outset, their family background and neighborhood census profiles were barely distinguishable from those of their black classmates. But what of later? What of later in life? 6 had dropped out of high school, and 8 had arrest records, 4 resulting in convictions. Most of their offenses were drug-related, paired with auto theft, assault, robbery, and shoplifting. 11 acknowledged drug use, including cocaine and prescription drugs. Among blacks, marijuana was the drug of choice. Among whites, the list was more expansive.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. But actually, there's an interesting context to that part of the project, because we talked to many more of the study participants than those numbers. But those are children who attended the same elementary school in West Baltimore, white and African American. It was an integrated school. I'm not at liberty to name the name, but I suspect you could figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
That school is situated in the area that was made infamous in the book The Corner, the David Simon and Edward Burns book.
Yeah.
And you'd never know that there were working class or low-income whites living in West Baltimore from that book. And you'd never know that children who had these kinds of experiences growing up as in adolescence, many of them would outgrow them. The book The Corner characterizes that neighborhood. I don't know if you're how many of your readers are familiar with it. It was published in 1998. It certainly made a big splash locally and nationally when it came out. It's a neighborhood that Simon and Burns tell us was devastated by an open-air drug market. And
Infested with it.
Yeah, infested. It's West Fayette and Monroe over in that side of the west side.
Franklin Square.
Yeah. So the thing about the book The Corner is that it's highly dramatized, and it puts forward a stereotyped picture of the people who are living in those neighborhoods. And we felt that all along, that in the book there are no sympathetic characters in the adult world of these young people that they're describing.
Sympathetic meaning employed, working, sending their kids to school, not selling drugs.
There are no caring teachers, there are no caring local store owners, there are no caring cops, there are no caring parents.
What did you find?
Well, we found that these neighborhoods, first of all, we looked at the census data, and they are indeed high poverty neighborhoods. Substantially, the one where The Corner is at is African American. But a lot of the people who lived in those neighborhoods finished high school, and some of them went on to college. The majority of residents, this is from census data, not our study, were employed, and they were employed at a surprising range of jobs. And that was none too surprising to us. There are other urban ethnographies of communities like the one in The Corner that establishes that most of the people living in these neighborhoods are what Elijah Anderson, who does a study in Philadelphia of a similar neighborhood, calls them decent folks. Mm-hmm. They're just trying to get on with their lives and stay out of trouble and do the right thing. You don't see that in the book The Corner. So the census profile tells us that the neighborhoods are more diverse than the book would have you think. And then it was entirely fortuitous that one of our schools, the largest of the 20, was located right at the edge of this, quote, The Corner. And so we had been talking with these young people from when they were in elementary school into their early 20s, and their experiences were also very diverse. And most of them finished high school. Some went on to college. There were dropouts. Most of them had problem encounters with the law of one sort along the way. But most young people who stumble in that way outgrow it eventually. Mm-hmm. In the broader literature, there's something that's referred to as age-delimited deviance.
Age-delimited.
Delimited
deviance.
So in adolescence or in the early 20s, a lot of people get into trouble, but most of them stop.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't have the sense of that from reading The Corner. Anyway, I don't want to go too far down the road, but we use that as a vehicle. We use this comparison of the experiences of our young people with the book as a way of establishing a couple things. One, the face of urban poverty isn't exclusively a people of color. There are poor whites and lots of them in places in Baltimore and in places like Baltimore. And the second important takeaway point is that even though many of them struggle in the early years, lots of them manage to kind of regroup and do quite well as they mature and move on in life.
Carl Alexander is our guest from the Sociology Department at Johns Hopkins University, chair of the department, outgoing chair, completing his career's work here, 25 years spent researching a cohort of nearly 800 Baltimore, now men and women. He first met them when they were 6-7 years old in first grade and followed them all the way through to their late 20s. The report is published now as a book called The Long Shadow, Family Background, Disadvantaged Youth, and the Transition to Adulthood. It's published by the Russell Sage Foundation. More with Carl Alexander when we get back. If you have a question about anything that we've covered so far in this hour, this is a good time to give us a call. 410-662-8780 is the number for Midday here on WYPR. Yeah, that Baltimore neighborhood that Carl Alexander was referring to before the break, 42% of households had an income over $25,000 a year. This is the working poor households. 25% earned $35,000 a year. But it doesn't diminish the fact that even law-abiding citizens, for them, the working poor, we call them, it's hard for them to get up and move on to step up the social ladder for their children.
Oh, absolutely. No, yeah. there's no denying that, and we certainly see those challenges in the experiences of our young people. When I was talking just a little bit back about the better employment opportunities of working class white men, that shouldn't be taken to say that they're doing extraordinarily well. I mean, they're doing relatively well, and their earnings are much higher than their African American counterparts, and their employment is more steady. They have better employment opportunities. But the young people who go on to college and benefit from the degree, one of the doors that a college degree can open, are doing much, much, much better than any of them. So they're, in terms of their earnings and in terms of the character of their jobs. It is true that the most secure route to upward mobility and doing well in the modern era is to be successful at school and to realize the benefits that come with that.
But you back that up, you go back a step to the family, coming back to the family again.
That's right? Exactly right.
Families, for instance, married couples where the head of household was not single, there was a married couple. How did those children do?
Compared to others, their children are more successful. But that's one consideration among many in terms of the family conditions.
We can go over those. Yeah. But that's the one I wanted to ask you about.
Yeah, but let me turn it in a somewhat different direction and say a bit about the family circumstances of these youngsters grown up as young adults. And so, as I've mentioned, there is this persistent pattern of sex segregation in the workplace that. These women tend to be employed disproportionately in the clerical and service sectors, mm-hmm. and men are able to access higher paying jobs. What we find if you look at personal earnings at age 28 of those who started out in lower family background circumstances, the personal earnings of women are uniformly low relative to men. And that's African American women and white women, okay? When you look at family earnings, that is, if you add together the earnings of the whoever the study participant is with his or her spouse or partner, we refer to that as a family union. Mm-hmm. And by partners, we try to identify more stable, longer-term partners. We screen on partnerships of at least 3 months' duration. What you see is that family earnings are in the vicinity of twice or more than twice personal earnings, which makes sense because you have a two-earner household in most of these situations. The large difference there is that white women of working class background are much more likely than our African American women to be in unions as adults, that is, to be married or live in partnership. So African American women are much more likely to be going it alone, as wholly dependent on their own earnings, which are low. Mm-hmm. White women are the beneficiaries of a second earner in the household. And the second earner typically is, when there is a second earner in the household for African Americans, that earner tends to be, the earnings are lower than in the white household. So.
Make sure I understand that. When they are in a union.
The person that they're living with and married to has lower earnings than corresponding in a white family.
Okay.
So African American men earn less. What it comes down
they're
to, if we're focused
less.
On women,
right.
African men earn less than white men as young adults. And so when African American women marry or partner with them, their family earnings are lower than the white family earnings.
I get you.
But what's critically important here is that far fewer of the African American women are married or in partnerships as young adults. And so they're going it alone. And so their personal earnings are being pitted against the family earnings of working class whites. 80% of working class white women are married or in a partnership. At age 28, 45% of African American women of modest background in her marriage partnership. Makes a big difference in terms of their financial.
We've examined that here on the show here a couple of times. We've devoted a couple of hours to that very, very subject. And we've had African American women on the show, bearing witness, testifying that, there aren't as many men around.
Right.
A lot of the men of their peers, their age peers, are in prison. We've heard this from many women in the course of a couple of programs here on Midday.
And we've heard it as well. I mean, that's the reality of what's out there. And it's challenging. The arrest and incarceration rates are very high for African-American, young adult African-American males. Their employment prospects are not great. And so they don't stand out as terrific marriage prospects or live-in partners.
Carl Alexander, you interviewed some of the members of this class, I'll call them the 800, in prison?
Oh, yeah, we did. A good many of them along the way. You know, keep in mind that we kept going back to them, so it wasn't one and done. So I think we had a total of on the order of 20 individual interviews with the study participants along the way, and many of them were done in lockups. What can I say? These were among our easiest to do because we could find them. You know, tracking a low-income population over many years is not an easy thing to do because they move frequently, residential relocation,
right.
Phone service gets cut off.
In terms of that, how many of them actually stayed in Baltimore?
About 60% overall.
60%?
Yeah.
Even within their own, the zip codes where you found them to begin with?
Well, they moved about in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was the migration stream within the city and outside the city is exactly as what you might have anticipated from what we know more generally. Lower income folks move about frequently within the city, and higher income families were more likely to leave the city.
I have this question for you. When you look at the trajectory of these lives, starting, they were born in the late 70s, hit first grade in 1982,
right.
And you follow them all the way up almost to the age of 30. So, you know, a lot has happened during that time in Baltimore City, a lot that's good, a lot that's bad. I'm thinking of a crack cocaine epidemic that we had in the late 80s, early 90s, and then high homicide rate in Baltimore, a loss of 10 to 11,000 residents per year for a lot of that. And then finally, we started to see some stabilization of the population in Baltimore. I just wonder, you know, the group you're looking at, they're adults now.
Yeah.
So I wonder, what can we draw from this in terms of what's happening in Baltimore today? Do we think the situation has improved any? Is it still going to be true if you're born poor, you're probably going to stay that way in Baltimore? What could you say about that?
Let me just say, I'll just add one thing to your little characterization. The loss of population wasn't just the loss of any old population. A lot of wealth left the city along with those people who moved out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, the time when these young people were growing up was a time of particular challenge, as you note. A report by the Casey Foundation in 2010 characterizes it as the perfect storm. It's deindustrialization, you know, the assault of drugs and just population loss and all that.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to think that it's all that's kind of leveled off and is starting to turn around. But it's hard to have the crystal ball isn't altogether clear as to what the future holds for Baltimore and places like Baltimore. What I would say, though, is that without some conscious and sustained attempts to kind of turn the ship around, the general patterns are likely to persist. I mean, family advantage is family advantage. And there are no evildoers here. Parents want to do what they can to help their kids. You know, that's human nature. It's basic instinct. And some parents are in a better position to be helpful than others. And that's always going to be the case. So opening up opportunities to be more successful
and
in
education.
School and in the workplace, education is a key.
It just emphasizes, it points up again the importance of fixing this education
Absolutely.
System.
That's fundamental. That's key.
Thank you for doing this, Carl Alexander. I didn't know you were doing it. I learned about it, your work only this week, and I congratulate you on this. And for the way it opens people's eyes to things, for some people it may confirm things I've already believed, but you know, we don't know these things unless we really study them and study them over a long period of time. So,
well, thank you for having me on and for having this opportunity to share with your listeners some of this work.
And we note also the contribution to this report of your late colleague Doris Entwistle again, and also Linda Olson. The three of them, their names on the cover of the book now, Family, The Long Shadow, it's called, Family Background, Disadvantaged Urban Youth, and the Transition to Adulthood. This report now compiled in a book published by the Russell Sage Foundation. Carl Alexander, congratulations on your career and your work. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to the first hour of Midday today. We'll take a break now for lunch, brought to us on Fridays by Joe Squared Pizza, located at 133 West North Avenue in the Station North neighborhood at the Inner Harbor at Power Plant Live. And you can find them on the web at joesquared.com. Please stay tuned for the news from NPR and then the second hour of our show, Midday Eats.